danger is stealing in as relapse comes above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day when you give in. Give in. Give in. Give in.
Hello and welcome to episode 194 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Catonsville, Maryland, I am Andrew Brookes. I'm by myself at the moment. As you heard on our previous episode, Nate Mavis is in the process of, or I suppose has completed purchasing a house and is in the process of, renovating and moving and just a number of other things he's busy with. So we do have Nate. He's going to be on our interview coming up later today. But at the moment, for your strategy segment, it's just me. We do have an exciting interview coming up. Our guest is Danny Sprung, maybe not a household name for everyone, but somebody with a kind of interesting and maybe not long running because he's just getting back into poker now, but someone who was playing in some pretty interesting poker games before the poker boom. We'll talk to him about that, and perhaps more strikingly, someone who is a national champion and a world master in bridge. Some of you probably have a better idea of what that means than I do. I've asked Nate to do some of the heavy lifting with regard to discussing bridge on this interview, but I don't know anything or don't know very much about bridge, so my role here will be to make sure that all of this is explained in terms that even people who don't really know anything about bridge can understand. So we'll be talking about hopefully some poker stories from the pre-poker boom, pre-moneymaker, pre-online poker era, and also talking about bridge with Danny Sprung coming up shortly. Our strategy segment, as always, is brought to you by Tournament Poker Edge. If you are interested in improving your tournament poker game in any way, whether you're a beginning player, an advanced player, someone who plays mostly single table tournaments or multi-table tournaments, small stakes or high stakes, you're going to find something that's useful to you at Tournament Poker Edge. And for as little as $25 a month, doesn't cost you much at all to check it out. I'm sure you're going to find some useful information. You'll find videos from me, videos from Nate, videos from many of our former guests. You can get all of that at tournamentpokeredge.com. Our strategy segment today is coming to us from Mike. Mike says, "Hello, I'm a longtime listener, first-time writer. I enjoy the podcast and particularly the strategy session. This hand happened when I was recently in Vegas playing 1-2 No Limit at the Venetian. I've been at the table for a couple of orbits and bought in for $200. Preflop raises have typically been between $8 and $15. Villain 1 has been active raising pre-flop. Generally, the table has had good action primarily due to Villain 3, who was just felted a couple of hands ago by being slow-played. He bought back in for $100. I've heard this is the fourth time he's been felted. This player, Villain 3, is talking a big game and is playing loose. I get a sense that everyone is waiting for him to make mistakes so that they can felt him again. I am in the small blind with $220. We are playing nine-handed. There's a fold, then Villain 1, the one who supposedly has been active raising preflop. Villain 1 raises to $12, Villain 2 calls, folds to the cutoff Villain 3, who also calls. Villain 1 and Villain 2 have the hero covered, which means $220 effective stacks with them. Villain 3, the player who is the good action in the game, has $105. Our hero is in the small blind with Ace of Diamonds, 10 of Clubs. And Mike goes on to say, I call, which seems to be pretty standard, but I'm going to go ahead and disagree with that. I don't think that this is a standard or a correct call. And just to recap the situation quickly, this is 1-2 No Limit. We've got an under the gun raise to $12, two calls, 100 big blind effective stacks with two of the players at the table, 50 big blind effective stacks with the guy who seems to be the best action at the table. So Ace-10 offsuit is not a hand that plays particularly well in a multi-way pot. It is a hand that plays somewhat well with shallow stacks, which is what we're going to have here. We're going to be seeing the flop with about $50 in the pot and $150 in the effective stacks. So what's going to happen is that basically we're either going to flop top pair, top kicker, or we aren't. Very occasionally we'll flop better than top pair, top kicker, but we certainly can't be looking at the implied odds of, you know, flopping two pair or flopping a straight, because relative to what we're going to pay to see the flop, there's just not that much to be won on the very rare occasion that we hit those hands. So with stack to pot ratio of about 3, we really need to be looking at how are we going to feel about our hand in situations where we flop top pair. So either 10 high flop or ace high flops. And so it's important to recognize first that this is not going to be a huge chunk of flops that fall into this category. The flopping the ace, of course, will always have top pair. It's not that rare for us to flop a 10 and still not have top pair. You know, there'll be a lot of flops that are like king 10x, queen 10x, jack 10x. Of course, ace 10x is good for us, but that's going to come along somewhat often. So there are going to be some situations where we flop like middle pair, top kicker, and that can be kind of a difficult situation to play. We do have some equity there, but I don't know that we necessarily want to be getting all in with the hand. And I think that, you know, perhaps more importantly, the issue here is that even when we get the ace high flop in a four-way pot dealing with an under-the-gun raiser, I think we can't expect ace 10 to be in such great shape if all the money goes in. So I think that it doesn't really make any sense for us to call with this hand and then say, well, we'll just have to wait and see what happens if we flop an ace or if we flop a 10. Like, we have to be ready to go with the hand in the situation where we flop top pair, or else this hand is definitely not worth playing. And the point I want to make is that I don't know that your hand is going to have that much value even on those particular flops. Ace 10 offsuit is just, it's an easily dominated hand, and in a heads up pot against, for instance, a late position raiser, that might not be such a concern. But when we're dealing with an under-the-gun raiser, you know, he's probably not playing a lot of hands that you have dominated, you know, hands like king 10 offsuit and queen 10 offsuit. Even though we've described this player as an active raiser, it's not entirely clear what that means, and I still wouldn't, you know, assume that he has hands that weak in his under-the-gun 6xing range. So first off is that just we're often going to be dominated by the under-the-gun opener, and then the second problem is that because it's a four-way flop, we really shouldn't expect that if there's an ace on the board, that people are going to be putting in, you know, another $150 if they don't have an ace. You know, if someone has even a hand as strong as like pocket kings or middle pair, I don't think it's that likely that they're just going to stack off to us when there's an ace on the board. So what that means is that we're not that often going to get a flop that's all that great for us to begin with. And even when we do get, you know, one of the nearly best case scenario flops with an ace or a 10 on it, we're still not necessarily going to have a hand that we can be that excited about playing for stacks. Like, I don't think we have really good implied odds on hitting an ace. In the same way that we might if we had ace king, I would probably even want to re-raise pre-flop, but, you know, with ace king on an ace high flop, even in a four-way pot with the effective stack being so shallow, you can expect that people will put money in with dominated aces. But here I think that you're going to be dominated more often than you manage to get in against someone that, whom you have dominated. So that's kind of the long and short of it, but I think this gets at a more fundamental problem that a lot of people have, which is that just if they have like a decent looking hand, they feel like they should see the flop. And particularly like in multi-way pots, people tend to think, oh, well, it's a pretty big pot, I'm getting pot odds, I guess I should call. And the fact, like, this being a multi-way pot really doesn't benefit you, because again, I think ace-10 is not a hand that holds up very well in multi-way pots. With more people seeing the flop, it becomes harder and harder for you to put your money in when you do have the best hand, and it becomes more likely that you're going to be beat if the money does go in on an ace or a 10 high flop. So I don't think the fact that this pot is multi-way helps you very much. You are out of position. That matters a little bit less when you're shallow, but it still matters. You're not getting a particularly great price. You're going to have to pay a fair amount of money to see the flop, and you just don't have a very good hand. So I actually think this is a pretty straightforward fold pre-flop. I don't think that you should just say anytime you have two decent looking cards, you know, call, see a flop, see what happens. I think you need more of a plan than that, and hopefully I've spelled out here why I don't think you really have a good plan with this hand. And I don't mean you specifically, Mike. I mean, it's not possible to have a good plan with this hand in this situation. So $50 in the pot, at the action again, $12 raise under the gun, 2 calls, our hero calls with ace 10 offsuit from the small blind. $50 in the pot, we see the flop, which is king, queen, jack with 2 hearts, and for what it's worth, our hero has ace of diamonds, 10 of clubs, so he does not have a heart. King Queen Jack, our hero, flops the nuts, and he says, "I check with the intention of check raising. Based on the action, it seems like the original raiser or villain three will bet this." And I'll just say, the fact that someone else is likely to bet is certainly, I mean, there's a good amount of value for you in checking and giving someone else a chance to bet, particularly given your position relative to the preflop raiser. You know, that you're going to have a very good relative position here. So letting him bet and perhaps get a call or a raise before you come in and sort of reveal the strength of your hand is certainly very appealing. I don't think that leading out here would necessarily be terrible either, especially if villain three is really the person you're targeting, because now you have the opportunity, if you bet here and get one or two calls and then villain three raises for you, I mean, that can be nice also. So I think it's not necessarily the case that you should always be checking just because you expect the preflop raiser to bet, because sometimes getting that person to raise can also be good. But I do think in this situation, I think you're right that this is a board that, you know, it's quite easy for the preflop raiser to have a hand like an overpair, top kicker, two pair, the kinds of hands that people are going to bet when checked to. This, by the way, is also why I think you should have folded the hand preflop, because he's so often going to have those kinds of hands that that often dominate you. But or sets is another important one that he can often have. So I think it's fine to expect that he'll bet here often, and then you can wait to call or raise after he does that. And often in multi-way pots, when you're out of position, you should be checking frequently, because it's just hard for you to avoid revealing strength if you just come right out betting into three people. So generally fine with the check. Villain one, so our hero does check. Villain one bets $40. Villain two calls. Villain three goes all in for $93. Michael says, "It's on me, and I don't spend a lot of time thinking about this, and go all in for $208 to, quote, protect my hand." Villain 1 and Villain 2 fold. Villain 2 shows pocket 10s when he folds. The board runs out blanks, while Villain 3 is yelling, "Pair the board," and belittling me for check-raising with a nut straight. Villain 3 mucks his hand. I scoop a nice pot. But then I start thinking that I could have scored bigger by calling the all-in, which likely would have brought Villain 1 and or Villain 2 along. And then I could bet half my stack on the turn and go all in on the river. It bothers me that while winning a nice pot, it was an opportunity to make more money. I let it later go over the hand independently with three people, and they all thought how I played the hand was correct. Let me pause here and say a little bit about this. The first thing that I like and I think is really good is that even though Michael won the pot and won a big pot, he's still thinking about how he could have done better. And I think this is just a really important thing for improving as a poker player, that it's easy to think that, you know, when you lose a pot, you made a mistake. When you win a big pot, you played well. And, you know, of course, it is important to look at ways to avoid losing big pots or to win pots that you could have lost or that sort of thing. But it's just as important to think about how you can win more when you do have the best hand, how you can lose less when you don't have the best hand, all that kind of stuff. So I think it's good that even though you won the pot, you're kind of thinking about how could I have done it better. I think that the two options I would kind of consider here would be either calling now and going all in on the turn, or just going all in now as you ended up doing. I don't think, you know, so what Michael says is, you know, I could have called now and then bet half my stack on the turn and gone all in on the river. And I encourage you to think a little bit about the pot size at this point. So if the hero does just call the all in, there's going to end up being, let's see, so we had 50, a bet of 40, and a call, so that makes it 130. Then the villain goes all in for 93, which is making it 225-ish. And then our hero is calling another 93. He's calling 93, which is going to make it like 320-ish. So there's going to be like $320 in the pot, and less than $100, I think, remaining in the hero's stack, or maybe about $100 remaining in the hero's stack. So I don't think that I would then be trying to bet $50 into a pot of 300 on the turn. I think that I would, you know, either put it all in now on the flop, which is only going to be, you know, another 100 into a pot of already 300, or Or I would call and then go all in for 100 on the turn. Those are the two options I think I would consider. And one of the reasons I would consider why I would want to get all the money in now rather than waiting until the river is that some of the hands that I'm trying to get action from are hands that may either outdraw me or fold by the river. And so if for instance, if we believe or we're considering the possibility that someone might have a flush draw, and reminder, there are two hearts on the board. Somebody with a flush draw may be willing to put in another $100 on the turn once the pot is large in order to see whether they hit the flush. But if they miss the flush, they're not going to put any more money in on the river. So rather than betting just $50 on the turn and giving them a chance to then, you know, play correctly for the last of the money on the river, you would be better off putting all the money in on the turn, especially if they're going to be willing to call it at that point. For instance, they may have a hand like a pair plus a flush draw or a straight plus a flush draw or a pair plus a straight draw. There's all these kinds of hands that are not going to put more money into the pot on the river unless they improve. And so you want to get the money in before we get to the river. So this is a concept that I call front loading, something that I talk about in my Getting Paid series on Tournament Poker Edge. And this is a situation where I certainly think you should be front loading, particularly given how large the pot already is. It's not like you have to bet a significant fraction of the pot in order to put all the money in. And in fact, people might be getting the correct odds to call you withdrawals. And this brings me to a second point that I want to make, and I'll read the remainder of Michael's email here. Michael says, "My gut keeps thinking I was wrong. When I put the numbers to it, I do think I misplayed it. When I go all in for 208, there's 441 in the pot, and Villain 1 has to put in 168 to call. That's 168 to win 609, or 28%. If he has a flush draw or flop trips, he's getting adequate odds to call. We would need to be playing deeper to really protect my straight. I explained this thought process and still got pushed back. The argument was after the call, what do I do on the turn if a heart comes or if the board pairs? I'm thinking that I'm going to get my money in anyway, so I'll need to check call if that's the case. The other argument was that if Villain 1 has hearts and Villain 2 has trips, then I'm no longer a favorite. My retort back was that the odds of both having such strong hands is small, and you can't live your poker life worrying about the quote monster in the closet. Also, they would correctly be calling anyway with my all-in bid if that's what they had." So I think there's some misunderstandings here about what exactly it means to, I really am not a big fan of talking about protection in this case in general. So when you say like protect my straight, the goal here is not to cause people to fold a flush draw. It would be nice if you could deny your opponents a profitable call with a flush draw. So if you could bet enough that they wouldn't be getting the right odds to call with a flush draw, that could be nice. However, if your only two choices are either give them a free card or force them to put in $168 with 28% equity, even if putting in the $168 with 28% equity is not negative EV for them, it can still be plus EV for you. It's certainly plus EV for you relative to giving them a free card. And the reason for this is just that there's a lot of money already in the pot. So you can imagine that how exactly I want to put this. I guess just to simplify the situation a little bit, let's say that there's $3 in the pot, and now you're going to flip a coin, and you have the option of now you're going to roll a die, and you have the option of either betting 50 cents or not betting anything. And your opponent has to either call the 50 cents or fold. So you can't, with $3 already in the pot, you can't deny your opponent the correct pot odds to call. Even if he can only win by rolling, by getting a single number, he's going to be correct to call your 50 cent bet. However, you still obviously make money by making that 50 cent bet because you're going to win it 5 times out of 6. So just because he has a plus EV call doesn't mean that you're somehow losing money by putting that in. It will often come up when there's, particularly in large pots, situations will come up quite frequently where both people are correct to put the money in. And what you're essentially doing is you're pushing an equity edge. You're forcing your opponent to pay you something in order to try to realize his share of the pot. And it might be the case that you would do even better if he folded, but that doesn't mean that that getting him to put the money in is somehow worse for you than letting him see the next card for free. So even if you can't get the very best possible scenario, which might be to have him fold away his equity, the very best scenario would be to have him call at a bad price, to have him call such a large amount that he's not actually actually getting the right odds. That would be the very best case scenario for you. The next best scenario would be to push him off of his equity. And you might not have room to do either of those things. But the third best scenario is going to be getting him to put in money from behind, even if he's, you know, getting reasonably compensated to do that. And that's what you have the opportunity to do here. And this comes back to my point about why you should be trying to put the money in before the river, why you should be trying to put the money in on the flop or turn, because these are the times when the villain will still be willing to put money in from behind. By the time we get to the river, he may no longer be willing to do that. The other point that comes up here is, what are we going to do if the turn is a flush card or a card that pairs the board? And I think, when you once again, at this point, even if you do just call, the pot is going to be so large that you're not going to be check folding a straight. So yeah, you are going to put the money in anyway. I actually think you'd probably be better off doing the shoving rather than checking and calling. It's not clear to me why you think that would, you know, suddenly become a check and call just because the turn card is not great for you. Essentially what you're doing there is you're giving the villain the opportunity to take a free card if he wants it, and to still win the maximum if he actually has the hand. So just because it's a bad turn card for you doesn't mean you should be checking and calling. I think you should be shoving any turn card if you do just cold call the flop. However, I think that the bigger concern with letting a flush card or a board pairing card come on the turn is that it might scare your opponent off of a hand that you would prefer him to call with. So for instance, let's say your opponent just calls your bet on the flop with a flush draw, and now the board pairs on the turn and you go all in. Your opponent might correctly fold his flush draw, whereas on the flop he would have put money in from behind. Now on the turn he gets to see that the turn card did not complete his flush, which is valuable information to him, and now he can correctly fold, and instead of putting in that money as a favorite, you don't win anything additional from him. And you know, he's folding because he's scared of something that you don't actually have, which is a full house, but he's still making the correct decision. Like, if he could see your cards and knew there's only one card to come, he would want to be folding his flush draw anyway. So you are helping him to make a correct decision. Likewise, if, you know, for instance, a flush card comes on the turn and your opponent folds a hand like two pair that's drawing very slim against you, that's also bad for you. You would rather get that money in on the flop. And I think that most people who have two pair are not going to fold the flop. So I think that, you know, once again, you probably are better off getting the money in now. This is another benefit of fast playing or front loading. Getting the money in now before the board gets any scarier for the kinds of hands that you're trying to win money from. The final point is that the hero might not actually be a favorite if one player has hearts and another player has trips. And if we define favorite as meaning you're going to win more than 50% of the time, that may be true. But in a three-way pot, you don't have to win more than 50% of the time to make money. So I guess the question I would ask you is, if you're not the favorite, who is? It's not the player who has hearts. It's not the player who has trips. Nobody wins more than 50% of the time. That doesn't mean no one makes money. You are going to win much more than 33% of the time, and therefore you do benefit from putting in money, getting 2-to-1. So I think there's some misunderstandings about how exactly pot odds and equity work, and hopefully this has helped to clear that up a little bit. I will also suggest I talk about this in some more detail in my Getting Off on the Right Foot series, also on Tournament Poker Edge. I think Theory of Poker is actually a book that can be helpful on some of this stuff as well. It's one of those oldie but a goodie kind of things that explains some pretty important fundamentals like this. I actually don't think it makes a huge difference whether you call, whether you check raise all in on the flop or call and go all in on the turn. I would err on the side of going all in on the flop, because I do think that a lot of second best hands, including like combo draws and two pairs, are going to pay you off now, and they may not pay you off on the next street. Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a matter of, like, don't get greedy. I think it's good that you're getting greedy. I think that's a really important part of trying to improve at poker, and you should be asking yourself, how could I have won more? But here, I think your line is good and correct, and I think that some of the arguments you're coming up with for doing something different don't really hold water. And most importantly, fold preflop, and I don't want that to get lost in all of this other stuff. You know, this is another thing that, you know, we tend to see a lot, is that when a big pot goes down, people worry a lot about the details of that exact situation, and sometimes miss a more fundamental mistake that happened here, which is that even though you got an extremely good flop and extremely good outcome, I think that the preflop is a pretty significant mistake, and it's a situation that comes up often, and really more so than making the right decision about whether or not to shove the flop. Just getting that preflop decision right consistently is going to be far more important to your long-term outcomes as a poker player. Thanks again for writing, Mike. and everyone else who wants to write, podcast@thinkingpoker.net. Hey everyone, I just wanted to give you a quick heads up. We had a little bit of an audio issue at the beginning of this interview. We lost the first 3 to 4 minutes of the interview. Everything else is there. You're not missing terribly much. We asked a little bit about how Danny got started on bridge, which I believe he said he had always been kind of interested in card games, saw his parents playing bridge, started getting curious about it, watching them, asking questions, eventually read a book about it, started playing it himself. And we basically pick up from there with me asking some more clarification about bridge and certain aspects of it. Sorry for the any inconvenience or confusion that that causes. But like I said, it was not terribly much, and we otherwise have a nice interview here with Danny. Enjoy. So one thing that's kind of unclear to me about bridge, I mean, I understand that in some sense, you know, communication plays a role in the game, and in poker, it's all about disinformation, right? It's, we're trying to communicate as little, at least as little truth as we can to our opponents. And it seems like in bridge, you, in some ways, you're meant to be communicating something to your partner, but there's limits on what and how you can communicate to that person. And it's kind of not clear to me, like, whether you're also meant to be deceiving your opponents, or if that's the thing that's against the rules, like whatever you're communicating to your partner, your opponents have to also understand. I guess I'm just kind of unclear on the role that, like, communication and deception play in bridge.
Yeah, so when you're communicating with your partner, you can only do so legally through the bids and card plays that you make. And any of those bids that you make, whatever understandings that you and your partner have decided on beforehand, the opponents are always entitled to all of that information. What you're not allowed to do is to try to give your opponents disinformation on the speed of which you play a card or the bid that you make. In other words, you can't, you know, hesitate in a situation where you know what you're going to play to try to deceive your opponent. That's very much a part of poker, and that's not at all allowed in bridge. In fact, if you do that and your opponent makes the wrong inference based on that, and it's possible that you're known to be in a situation where you could know that that could be gaining for your side, the tournament directors will take that result away from you. So that's not a part of the game at all.
Is it correct then to say that disinformation is not really part of the game, or are there other ways in which, you know, deceit does play a legitimate strategic role?
Oh, you can definitely use deceit, and there's a lots of strategic chances to do so in legal ways. Your bids don't have to show they have the same sort of values or cards that you're supposed to have, as long as your partner's not aware of that ahead of time. And you're also allowed to play certain cards that seem illogical to the opponents, and they may have to decide whether you really only have that one card to play, or you're making a what's called a false card. You're not playing the natural card that you could play to follow suit. You're playing a higher card in a situation where you're trying to deceive them. And that's all very much a legal part of the game.
But then the idea then is that your partner doesn't have any information that your opponents don't have. So like anything that you're doing, other than knowledge of the cards in his hand, so anything that you're doing to deceive your opponents would have the potential to be kind of just as deceitful to your partner?
Yes, that's true. Although when you're declaring the hand and your partner's the dummy, there's no worries about that at all. You're free to do whatever you want because your partner's out of the play. Mm. So just, you know, I'm not sure all of your poker players know it, but when you're playing bridge and you get to the play of the hand, one of the people becomes the dummy and they're not involved in the play of the cards at all.
Ah, okay. I didn't fully appreciate that either.
Yeah. So after the bidding is over, when the play starts, one side is still both people are playing. One side is controlling both his cards and his partner's cards. And that's where the expression the dummy comes from, because they're dumb. They don't get to say anything or do anything. They just sit there and play the cards that you tell them to play. So when you get to that point, obviously the person who's the partner of the dummy can make as many deceptive plays as they want without any risk of fooling their partner, whereas the defenders are working in tandem when you make a deceptive play, that has just as much chance to fool your partner as the declarer. So you need to judge whether or not that's, you know, more likely to work in your benefit or your opponent's.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you.
So the question I tried to ask earlier when my audio failed is, do you internally or externally laugh at poker players who talk about all the quote-unquote complicated math they have to do when the arithmetic you have to do over the table and bridge is orders of magnitude more complicated?
Not really. I mean, a lot of the arithmetic that's necessary to bridge is stuff that you can learn ahead of time and memorize the really important basic probabilities.
Okay.
So it's not really that much more difficult, as you know, from my, you know, from my perspective, and maybe that's because I've been playing for a long time and I understand only important, relevant mathematical situations. But
I see. So I mean, I guess to bring our listeners up to speed, and this is me trying to remember things from like 15 years ago, so I apologize in advance. But so there are situations where where it matters a lot. So there are eight cards out in a suit, and if it breaks four and four, you should do one thing, and if it breaks any other way, you should do another thing. And on the one hand, so you know, knowing that probability that it's four and four is not so difficult, but conditioning that, you know, finding that probability, conditioning on all the bidding that's happened and all the other stuff that's happened in the hand, that seems very complicated to me. Is that right?
Right, that gets the more complicated situations where, you know, say one of your opponents has six cards in one suit and another opponent has only two in that suit, how the other suits are now going to break.
Yeah.
And yeah, that gets into more complicated stuff. But the general rules for how to adopt for that are not that difficult, it turns out.
Oh, okay.
Because say you know your left-hand opponent has six spades, your right-hand opponent has two spades, now you know that any other given card is far more likely to be in your right-hand opponent's hand. You don't really need to know that the right ratio is 11 out of 16, but, you know, you just need to know that it's more likely or not.
I see.
And, yeah, the math that you need to know is not too difficult. You know, you need to understand how it works and why it works, but it's not that, you know, knowing the exact answer, whether that's 68% or 62%, doesn't really change what the best play is likely to be.
I see. And that's a real parallel with poker, right? Where, you know, you get a lot of people who are very proud at knowing the probabilities down to the tenth of a percent, maybe, instead of the full percent. But that almost never makes a difference to the correct play. And if it does, the EV difference is very close to zero, almost by definition.
Yeah, if the two plays are really close together, it doesn't really matter which play you make anyway.
Yeah.
So, and that's a similar conclusion you can make in bridge as well.
Well, yeah, and in poker, like knowing what your chances on an eight outer is, you know, if you're off by a couple percent, that's not great, but I'll spot you that couple percent. If I'm better at figuring out what the other guy's range is pre-flop, you know, usually that makes much, much bigger difference to what the right play is.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It was predicted a while ago. I think David Sklansky once wrote that if either mixed games got too popular or exotic mixed games got too popular, or if people ever started playing poker where you made up rules on the fly, that bridge players would overtake the poker world and all the best players in the world would be bridge players. Mixed games have in fact gotten more exotic and more complicated, but as far as I know, bridge players have not taken over the world of poker. Do you think that's surprising?
I think most bridge players who would be good enough to do so, actually there are some bridge players who have done well at both high stakes cash games and in some of the big tournaments in Las Vegas and et cetera. But I think that, yeah, if you threw them all into the pool at the same time, the bridge players might be able to swim faster, but I'm not sure that they really want to go jumping into that pool when they have their own little milieu to stay in.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. And so bridge players do, like, it's if you're that good at bridge, you can do well enough at bridge where the prospect of studying really hard for a couple of years so that you can beat 400, 800 cash games is not that appealing?
Well, I'm not sure. Beating 400, 800 cash games would be pretty appealing to most top-level bridge players. I think that they're all comfortable. You know, the ones who are good at both games tend to be comfortable with where they are right now in bridge.
Okay.
So, yeah, and you know, we can get into discussions of how the professional bridge program works, and that's all a very different format than the way poker works.
Hey, Danny, how does the professional bridge, you know?
Okay, so yeah, I'm glad you asked that. The way there early on in bridge, there were some cash prizes, and there was bridge played for money, but that sort of died out, mainly because the better players won too fast from the weaker players. So the evolution of professional bridge is now that instead of playing each other for money, the best players get hired by sponsors to play on their team. And usually the sponsor is playing on that same team. So there'll be a team of four or six players, one of whom will be a wealthy sponsor, and they will hire the people to play with them in national and world championships and even down to lower level games as well. So that's sort of how the bridge world works as far as what the professionals do. They generally are playing on teams where there's one player who may be almost as good or even as better than they are, but who's wealthy enough to hire them to play. And that's how the bridge world works as far as that's concerned. And the very top players do quite well, and there's probably a couple of hundred players who do less well, but well enough to make a living at it. So
I see. And do you have experience? I mean, I guess this will be part of the introduction maybe, but do you have experience in this sort of thing?
I'm what I would call a serious amateur, both at poker and bridge. I don't really play professionally. I have a couple of times just on like an emergency basis when somebody else couldn't play or something like that. But I don't really play professionally.
What's the incentive here for the sponsor? I mean, is this just like an ego thing that they want to be on a willing team and they're willing to pay to do that, or is there something more to it?
Yeah, that's generally it. They're also playing though, so it's not just that they're on the team. They actually have to be playing, you know, half of the hands. They're in there playing as well.
Sure.
So, you know, the ego of doing well is one thing, but they're also actually winning the event. It's not like McDonald's is sponsoring the Yankees. It's more like one of the players who's on the Yankees is actually sponsoring them. So they get to actually win the tournament as well. And for most of the sponsors actually do play, although there are one or two in the past and current who don't play and just are happy to have their team name out there.
Mm-hmm.
But generally it's ego, but it's also fun playing in the finals of major events, just like it'd be fun getting to the finals of the World Series of Poker. It's fun to play in the finals of the World Championships or one of the big national championships here in America.
So I guess we could see something similar to the, you know, like the WSOP introduced this year, a team tournament.
Right.
And I mean, I didn't hear of it happening, but I guess it would be sort of the equivalent of if you paid someone to be on your team. Although I guess in the bridge, you know, the requirement is that you actually are 50% of the team. Whereas, you know, the WSOP rules would enable you to maybe not actually participate that much, but it would be kind of comparable where you're playing and there's something exciting about getting deep in a WSOP event. And if you can, you know, afford to hire some very good player to help you do that, then you can kind of buy your way into that excitement.
Yeah, right. That's exactly the same idea.
Yeah. And don't give him any ideas. Next year, he's going to make me like do his laundry to play on Andrew's team again.
Well, I can see, you know, hiring somebody else to play on my poker team so I could get to the final table of the World Series of Poker. And that would be fun. In the same way that a bridge player would do the same thing. So, yeah.
And so how did you get started playing poker? How did you make that? I mean, was it? Did you think of it as a transition, or was it just like another fun card game?
Just more like another fun card game. I remember, you know, as a teenager, sometimes my sister would and her older friends would have a poker game, and I would play in that or play a little in college. And I was sort of off and on, not really too serious about it, but just I always seemed to do well at it, so I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed it. And then I was a trader on the Philadelphia Stock Exchange in the early 1990s, and there were a bunch of good poker players there, and we actually had our own little what I would call a home game at the office, and we would play 5-10 dealer's choice, and I really enjoyed it then. That was in the mid-90s. And since then, I've always been an off and on poker player. Now that I've actually moved to Las Vegas, where it's easy to play anytime I want to, I've been getting to play a little bit more again. So that's a good thing. And
so I think that's the first time I've ever heard someone credit their older sister with getting them into poker.
Yeah. More her friends. I think, you know, they were playing and she'd be doing other stuff with other friends who weren't playing in the poker game. But I still remember playing at my parents' dining room table and with a bunch of older guys and beating them out of their money and having a good time at doing it. So, yeah.
And I mean, did you get sort of serious about it, or was it just like it was a fun hobby when you were a kid and then you had the opportunity to play in this game, you know, again, really just recreationally when you were on the stock exchange?
Yeah, that's when I got a little more serious about it. I wouldn't say I really, you know, it's not like I studied a lot. I did have some of the early Sklansky books and stuff like that. And some of the players actually turned out to be quite good players in our game. A couple of the guys from Susquehanna Investments who uses poker as part of their training methods. And Matt Glantz also played in that game early on in his poker career. So it was a good game. So it was a good way to learn. And that sort of got me towards going to Atlantic City a little more often. And then when the poker boom came, I joined some of the online sites. I did well on some of them before they got shut down. So it's sort of been on and off for the better part of the last 25 years. And now that I've actually moved to Vegas, like I said, I can play more when I want to. I can play some local tournaments and such. So that's how I got into poker.
I guess your background as a trader, I was going to ask. So what I thought I was going to ask you was, what was it like taking a big loss at poker for the first time? Because, you know, maybe you've been playing card games your whole life and you haven't ever taken a big loss at a card game. But your background as a trader probably got you used to the swings. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. Trading was, not quite as swingy as poker. It tended to be more a somewhat steady up climb with an occasional bump in the road. And I did develop some methods towards dealing with my losses in trading that I don't know that they translate very well to poker, but when I had a bad day at work, I would sort of say, all right, I would go out and figure out exactly how much money I thought I lost and sort of draw a line under that and say, all right, I lost 5,000 or 10,000, whatever the number is, and then get back to work to trying to make it back. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't really translate too well into poker, I guess, although the numbers are always right there for you. It's a little more complicated trading, but
yeah. And chasing the loss is pretty often a bad idea.
Yeah. Yeah. Chasing losses trading was never part of my general style. I was a very conservative trader. I did, you know, try to stay close to the line, so to speak.
I see.
I'm curious if this is something that you can talk about kind of the logistics of playing in what I imagine was like a private, you know, not legally sanctioned game.
You mean the one at the exchange?
Right. Like that. I mean, you weren't playing at like a public card room, right?
No, we were playing at my office upstairs.
And was this was this a relatively high stakes game?
It was just 5-10 limit.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. We're not talking about like tens of thousands of dollars changing hands?
No. No, okay. It was very friendly.
I just heard like Trainers, Wall Street, poker. I just kind of assumed it was.
Yeah, it was always intended to be friendly. More, you know, some of the people who played in it were. It was a stake that was much lower than they're used to playing, but they still played it seriously because it was people who were friendly with each other. So that sort of made it good. Mm. And there wasn't, you know, it wasn't any issues with it being illegal or there was no rake. There was no, I was the one who sort of ran the game, so to speak, but I didn't, you know, do anything like that.
Okay. I guess just kind of interesting stories from that day, either about Matt specifically or just, I mean, I kind of get the sense there were maybe more characters in playing poker at that time than we might encounter now that it's become a little bit more popular and maybe even sanitized.
Yeah, there wasn't too many interesting stories from that game. I mean, it's sort of a little bit, you know, it's a long time ago now, but I don't really remember too much crazy happening. It was just generally a fun game where we all got to play different games that you wouldn't necessarily see too much at a casino before. You know, we didn't play much no limit, but more, you know, Omaha 8 and stuff like that, which wasn't really that popular back then, that you could just, all right, this is my turn to play 10 hands of the game I want to play. So that was fun, but there wasn't too much wild stuff. It wasn't like you would read in one of these books where there was crazy stuff going on.
Which variants of poker do you prefer?
I my favorite game is Stud 8, but it's so hard to find a game where you can play that unless you're playing for nosebleed stakes or it's part of some big mixed game that I wouldn't really want to play some of these other games I don't really know. It's the game I enjoy the most. I think it does have a lot of good psychology and math elements to it, so I like that.
Have you ever gotten into a high-low regular game out there in Vegas? I played a ton of that in Las Vegas a little while ago, but I think that's been replaced in mixes with other games.
Most of the casinos I play in, they just have Omaha 8, which I don't find nearly as interesting. Mm-hmm. So I tend to, you know, most of my casino poker time is more towards daily tournaments, and obviously mostly no limit hold'em, so I don't really get to play much of that.
And the impetus for you kind of getting reinterested in poker, you said, was moving to Las Vegas?
Yeah, that was one of them, just the availability of it. I mean, when you could play online, I enjoyed playing online a lot, but it's not quite the same thing as playing live.
And you prefer playing live?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's nice to be able to just turn on the computer and say, all right, I'm going to play for 20 minutes and then, or play a sit and go or whatever, but I think playing live is more fun.
What was the impetus for moving to Vegas?
Well, my wife and I had always wanted to move here at some point, and I had always suggested, well, we'll move here when I retire because I don't really want to get up at 5:30 in the morning to go to work, which is what I do. And I finally decided, well, I really enjoy Vegas. Let's just see what it's like, and that's what we did. And so now I'm used to getting up at 5:30 in the morning. My day is done at 1, so then I can do pretty much what I want the rest of the day, which is nice.
I tend to assume, you know, people who say, I enjoy visiting Vegas, so I'll move there, are making a pretty big logical leap. Was that, did you have more experience of it than just being kind of like a weekend tourist?
Yeah, we did. We actually have friends who live here from Bridge. Okay. And we came and we would stay with them and we would see what it's really like to live here as a local as opposed to, you know, being on the strip and staying in a hotel. We were staying in a house and doing the things that you would do if you actually lived here as opposed to being a, you know, a regular tourist.
Yeah, I think that's the way to do it.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, staying for, you know, 10 or 12 days and really getting a feel of what it's like. And also the fact that we had a bunch of other bridge playing friends who lived here made it more attractive to move here as well.
Now, I've kind of heard, and maybe this is just with regard to higher stakes games, that Vegas is actually kind of dry poker-wise right now. I guess if you're primarily interested in playing daily tournaments, maybe that's not the case, though.
Right.
Where?
Yeah, I don't really go down to the strip too much. I generally play at Red Rock, which is, you know, a locals casino.
Oh, yeah. That's
their daily tournaments have like 30 or 40 people, and, you know, they have a decent card room. It's not super. The biggest game is usually just a 2-5 no limit, so it's not really too much going on.
Yeah, Nate and I try to hit the Red Rock like once a year when we're out there. It's I just think, you know, it's so sort of spacious, and you can get good beer at the table, and I enjoy playing at Red Rock.
Yeah, it's a nice room. And, you know, the dealers are friendly and professional, and I really enjoy it there. Plus, I don't really want to hassle with going down to the strip and dealing with parking and such. So sure. Just so much easier to go to the locals casino. And I sort of lived in that direction already anyway. So.
And the poker is very much a sort of hobby thing for you. I mean, I understand you want to be good at it, but you're not really looking at it as like an important component of your income.
No, not at all. It's definitely a serious amateur sort of situation.
And it doesn't feel to you like a busman's holiday if you're trading and then going straight from that to poker?
No, not at all. It's something I really enjoy doing. So it's not, you know, it's definitely not work. It's something that I'm doing because I enjoy it.
But I imagine you do see some similarities between trading and poker?
Yeah, very much so. You're using sort of the same muscles, so to speak. So you're thinking sort of in a similar way and such. Yes, definitely.
Is there anything that you feel like kind of leads you in the wrong direction? Like that there's something that you would do as a trader that would actually end up being a pretty big mistake as a poker player, or vice versa?
I tend to be more conservative probably than a poker player should be. And I sort of am forcing myself to play a little looser and a little more aggressively than I might otherwise. Mm-hmm. But other than that, not really.
Yeah, that's kind of what I had in mind, actually, because I think sometimes I've had people, either because, you know, they're serious investors themselves, or just, you know, they understand something about investing because they have money that's invested, and they kind of have the idea of, like, risk minimization, you know, really at the forefront of their minds when they're thinking about poker. And I mean, my approach to that anyway tends to be that the risk minimization part is kind of playing with an appropriate bankroll. And once you have an appropriate bankroll, you're not making decisions, like while you're actually playing in the game, you're not making decisions along the lines of like, oh, I really want to avoid, you know, losing a 200 big blind pot at basically at all costs. And I want to, you know, do things like try to bet somebody off of a draw rather than, you know, risk them getting there or something like that. Like, I think risk minimization in that regard tends to be pretty expensive. I do think having like an appropriate bankroll is correct, but yeah, I mean, is that the kind of thing that you have in mind when you say like being overly conservative?
Yeah, one of the first important lessons I learned in trading is that the most important thing is to be able to get up and trade the next day. And I learned this lesson sort of in spades because I started October 1st, 1987, and within 3 weeks was what I call the real crash, not sort of like 2008 where the market just went down every day. This was the market down 20% in one day, which especially for an option trader where the leverage is so much greater than it is for a regular equity trader, it was very easy for people to go out of business. And that's sort of something that has stuck with me for, what is it, almost 30 years now. So yeah, it's really important to be able to come back and trade the next day because you never know when the next good game, so to speak, is going to be another. There's going to be a great new stock to trade or just a new opportunity or a new way to make money. And being in business is the bottom line for that. And that, you know, that gets the same thing as what you're talking about with bankroll and poker. You want to make sure that you don't want to blow your bankroll today and find out tomorrow that in your regular 5-10 game, there's a really great fish that just came into town who's in there spewing money left and right. You want to be able to make sure that you can get into the game and stay in the game.
Do you have a dedicated poker bankroll?
No, I do not.
I guess for you, it's just, I mean, as an amateur, you probably wouldn't have to worry that much about risk of ruin anyway, and maybe the stakes you're playing, or you're not really at that
right
at that point,
yeah,
anyway.
Well, I did play the main event of the World Series this year, but generally speaking, I'm playing, you know, $70, $100, $125 tournaments.
Right.
I'm doing well enough at them that I'm definitely making money. And it didn't pay for my World Series this year, but it certainly put a big dent in it.
How'd you enjoy the main event?
Oh, it was a blast. I would highly recommend it to anybody who ever says, well, I want to do it one time. I would really say that you absolutely should. In fact, one of my good bridge friends is interested in playing and doesn't really want to put up the $10,000, and his wife is sort of like pushing him, yes, you should go do it. And I've been trying to help him down that road. You just got to try it one time. It's just so much fun. It was great. Great to play in that.
Sorry, did I cut you off, Nate?
I was going to ask the same question you did. I was wondering. It's,
Have you played any other WSOP events besides the main?
Yeah, I played... I played back in 2000. I played in a Limit Hold'em event back before the poker.
Oh, nice.
Room, obviously. And I remember in that event playing against Phil Hellmuth and check raising him and him literally almost trying to tear his cards apart, saying, they've been making their hands against me all day and trying to tear his cards out. I couldn't do it and he finally threw him into the muck. So, that's a story that I remember always remember. And I played a couple of events the last 2 years before this year, and I did cash in one of them. And I played in the Colossus and made a second day, but then I busted right away. But yeah, I've played a few here and there.
What's been your process? I mean, as someone who was kind of into poker a long time ago and then is getting back into it now, I guess first, I mean, have you noticed big changes, not just in, you know, who's playing poker, how many people are playing poker, but in the way poker is being played now? Were there any like culture shocks for you as you got back into it?
Oh, very definitely. I'm still back in the pre-poker boom, tight, aggressive 3x opening. You know, you put a player on a hand and then you go from there, and, you know, well before all the stuff with ranges and small ball and all that stuff, that's really changed the way poker's played. It's really very, very different from back when I was first playing. So yeah, that's a very big change in the way the game is played.
What's been your process for getting caught up on modern poker theory?
I've been listening to your podcast and a few other podcasts as well. I've been trying to read as many of the newer modern books as I can. And I don't really have one of the things that helped me learn in bridge was having a network of other players who I was friendly with to talk about hands after the game was over. And I don't really have that same sort of network in poker yet. But I think about the hands afterwards, and I think about the hands that I feel like I misplayed, and occasionally I'll post on 2+2 to get some feedback on them. And yeah, that's the sort of stuff I've been doing.
So I guess you mentioned, you know, one of your means of improving at bridge was being able to talk with other players, and you haven't found that in poker. Were there any tools that you were able to use for getting better at bridge that you have been able to use in poker as well?
Just actually, the main tool is for any game to get good at is to really enjoy playing it and to immerse yourself into it as much as you can, to read about it and to play as much as you can. And that's, you know, when I was younger and learning bridge, I couldn't really play. Like when I was 13 or 14 years old, my parents weren't really keen on me playing 3 or 4 times a week. So in order to get better, I had to play as much as I could and then read and work away from the table as much as I could. And that's obviously, I would make the same suggestion for anybody trying to get better at poker.
So how good exactly did you get at bridge? Like, I can see I found a list of some of your bridge accomplishments online, but just for someone who doesn't, you know the context for those, like how good were you?
Well, or are you? I'm not at the very top level. The top level players are generally people who are full-time professionals who really dedicate their lives to the game. And even if I had, I suspect I would fall one level short of them. I've played in several world championships. The best I did was making the round of 16 of an open world championship, which is like when I say the round of 16, it's a knockout event like a tennis tournament. Mm-hmm. And you get down to, you know, start with a whole bunch of teams. It started with about 160 or 170 teams and got down to the last 16 where our team was a big underdog to get that far, and we did well to get there. And then we lost to a team that subsequently one of the pairs has been basically added from bridge for cheating. So I feel like, while we lost in the round of 16, we certainly had a chance to even do better than that if we hadn't been. And we lost a match that was pretty close. We could have easily won it. And to find out later that some of your opponents are cheating sort of makes it a little bittersweet.
Sure.
Yeah, it's tough. How were they cheating?
Well, this particular pair was cheating. The way bridges played in tournaments, instead of bidding out loud by saying one spade, we have printed cards that say one spade on them. And each time you make a bid, it overlaps the previous bid. So you might bid one spade, and then a little bit further to the right, your next bid might be two hearts. Well, the way this pair was cheating was they were varying the spaces between the bids. If they had a strong hand, they would put the bids closer together. If they had a weaker hand, they would put them further apart. Huh. And now their partner knew, you talk about poker ranges, they knew within whatever range they were showing, whether they were at the high end of the range or the low end of the range.
I see. So, like, back when I was reading books, whatever, I have in my head somewhere that if you open one no trump, it means 15 to 18 high card points. And so if it's like 15, I would put them really close together, and 18, I would put them really far apart or something? Is that
something like that, exactly, okay. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the idea. So now for the rest of us, we would have to ask partner with our next bid whether they have the high end of the range or the low end of the range. Yeah. Well, this pair already knew that their partner had either the higher or the low end of the range.
I see. So they would end up in the right contract a lot more than they should.
Right. And they, you know, sometimes to find out if your partner has the high end of the range, you have to bid more, which puts you in danger of not making your contract.
Yeah.
A simple example would be your no-trump example. If you wanted to invite your partner to bid game and only have them bid game when they have the high end of the range, you have to bid, say, two no-trump. Well, if you know your partner has the low end of the range, you don't have to do that. And now if the limit of the hand is only one no-trump, they're going to get a plus score, whereas you would get a minus score.
I see. And that's a very big swing, right? So making a contract is good. Getting set means that the other team gets it. Like my understanding, and again, probably wrong, is that a lot of these tournaments, a lot of the differences are just making one extra trick compared to your opponents, right? Or trying to get these small edges and going from even if occasionally they can make a contract where a lot of others would get set, those are enormous swings that would really help them a lot.
Yeah, and that sort of advantage over one hand may not be huge, but over the course of 60 hands, which is what the typical important tournament plays in a day, they add up pretty quickly.
I see. That sucks for you. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
Ouch. Yeah.
Unfortunately, cheating has been a part of bridge since basically the beginning of contract bridge as we know it. Up until just recently, there was a major cheating explosion that happened as the money got better in bridge. Several top pairs were cheating. And just last year, there was a big expose where several of them got caught and were thrown out at the same time.
Oh, wow. How did that come to light?
It came to light in an interesting way. One of the people who was playing on a team with one of the pairs that was cheating actually changed teams and then lost a match to his cheating teammates. And he went back over the hands and realized, well, geez, I think these guys were cheating. And at the same time, the European championships had been taped. So now there were miles and miles and miles of videotape on YouTube to be analyzed, and they went back and they figured out what this particular pair was doing was they were taking the tray where the cards are stored and moving it in various parts of the table to indicate which suit they would prefer their partner to lead.
Huh.
So if they wanted a club lead, they might put the tray to the right. If they wanted a diamond lead, they put it to the left. And now their partner knew which suit they wanted to make the opening lead on, which is an even bigger advantage than the other pair had that what I was talking about.
Yeah, this seems like a situation that just screams out to be played on computers, like some sort of secure computer terminal. I imagine that would be unacceptable from the perspective of the culture of the game.
Yeah, most people are very much against that, and that is sort of where the culture is going, but a lot of the, you know, traditionalists are really very unhappy with that idea.
I see. So. How do you feel about it?
I have mixed emotions as well. I mean, I would love to see all the cheating in the game go away. I like the fact that they're taping the high-level events now so that if you are cheating, you're much more likely to be caught. And, you know, so.
I once heard a story where somebody asked for a review of the bidding with inflections, and I thought that was pretty funny.
That's actually a famous story. A review of the bidding with all the appropriate inflections.
Yeah, okay. That's...
That's back in the day before we used these bidding cards or bidding boxes that they called. You would bid one spade out loud, so you could say one spade, you could say a spade. In fact, there was a pair of people who were discussing the difference between IW and IV spades as to how defensive oriented or how offensive oriented it would be.
Mm-hmm.
So you can say, all right, I've got a good hand, but I'm just doubling because I've got a good hand, or I've got a good hand because I've got a bunch of spades and they're playing four spades. So you can sort of, you know, give your partner extra information that way. And that was eliminated with the bidding boxes. And that's, you know, every new counter step is met with a different way of, let's get around this by the way we use the actual cards that we're using to stop them from cheating. We're actually going to use those against people, and we'll space them differently, or we'll put them in the tray differently, or we'll do something that will make it that we can cheat again.
Yeah, it's funny. There's a poker lesson there. It's so information is just everywhere, and it's so hard not to leak it. You know, it's people think it's easy, but it's really not. I think, yeah, especially if you're trying to.
Right. The difference in between poker and bridge, though, bridge you have a partner that you're trying to communicate with, and poker you're trying to fool people. So
yeah,
it's if you can communicate with your partner and the opponents don't know it, that's such a huge advantage.
Yeah. So we have a lot of poker players in the audience who can't play poker as much as they would like to. I'm such a person. I've sort of taken up Hearthstone, but I imagine that other people are looking for a really great card game with a rich, you know, cultural heritage to get into. If they think that bridge might be for them, how should they start?
They should start by, well, there's a book called Bridge for Dummies, which is a good way to get introduced to it. The best way beyond that is to get, the way I started was, once I knew the basics of the game, was to go to the local bridge club and get lessons from a player who would teach you how to play. Now, the easiest way to start is to just get, like, be part of a group lesson where you're learning the fundamentals of the game. But once you want to get to the next level, if you can afford it, the best way is to actually hire somebody to play with you, to play at the local club. And after the round is over, you just go over the hands and you can learn everything that you should have done better. And that's really the best way to get better is by playing with and against better players. Just as it is in poker, I'm sure that, you know, beating up on the 50-cent dollar game isn't going to make you a good enough player to win the World Series of Poker, but, you know, playing against stronger and stronger games is the best way to make your game better. And the same holds for bridge.
Well, I've run through most of my questions, and I think we've taken as much time as we said we would take of yours. Do you have more questions, Andrew?
No, I just say thank you again for sharing this. I hope my questions weren't too... My only hope is that my level of ignorance matches that of the audience, because I'm sure I'm sure some of my questions seem foolish to you.
No, none of them did. And thanks so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
It's been great. Can I just apologize to Matt Glassman real quick for not having better questions? I'm sure, you know, he's friend of the show, big bridge guy. So,
okay.
But thank you very, very much for coming on. And I really, really, really great to meet you. And thanks again.
All right. Thanks.
Take care. Have a good night.
All right.
Some kind of pill, or the devotion of a Carmelite, or the fair passage of a bill.